Alright, there is a live mic on now. Making sure that's on.
Okay.
Alright, and now we have two recording machines on, so I'm going to go ahead and read a biographical sketch.
Okay.
And then we'll get started. My name is Abigail Delph, a service learning assistant with the Department of History, Indiana University, Purdue University. Today is July 15th, 2016, and this is the second recording session with Ginger Merkel at the Wells Fargo Advisor's Office, located in Indianapolis, Indiana. This interview is part of an oral history project to celebrate the Red Cross of Indiana's 100th anniversary. For this project, we are interviewing people who volunteered or worked for, donated to, or were helped by the Red Cross of Indiana. Dr. Philip Scarpino, the director of the Public History Program at Indiana University, Purdue University, is the project supervisor. A biographical sketch can be found on the first interview with Ginger Merkel from July 5th, 2016. Before we get started, I'd like to ask you, Ginger, your permission to record the interview, to transcribe the recording if funding becomes available, and to place the recording and transcriptions, if we make them, in the IEPY archives and special collections, as well as the American Red Cross of Indiana, and for the use of their patrons.
I give you permission.
Thank you. All right, let's get started.
Okay.
So before we continue with some of our questions that from last week, I wanted to touch base on some follow-up questions.
Okay.
You mentioned at our interview July 5th that Bill McConnell, upon being elected to the board, decided to shrink the board down around 1992-1993.
Mm-hmm.
Why did he want to shrink the board?
We had a 56-person board, so the running of the organization was done primarily by the executive committee.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the board members were very disengaged. None of them were donors. It was a highly dysfunctional group of folks, and in order to have effective leadership, Bill and all of us felt that the board needed to be much smaller and the board members needed to be engaged as volunteers and as donors.
Mm-hmm. And then what was the process of shrinking the board?
Basically, we let everybody term out. So it was a board that had term limits. Those are part of the national governance documents, and so in many cases when we notified board members that they would be required to be contributors and also volunteer on a committee,
mm-hmm.
they took themselves elsewhere because a lot of them just put the Red Cross on as a they were obituary builders, and
mm-hmm.
so they were using us on their resumes, but they weren't really engaged with the organization. So
did you deal with that problem firsthand?
Yeah, my initial reaction was, you know, let's just chop everybody's head off that isn't doing their job, and cooler heads prevailed, and Bill suggested that maybe we deal with it on a case-by-case basis in places where, you know, we were pretty sure the person would like a graceful exit. And so that we did. It took us about 3 years to get the board down to a normal size. They had increased the size of the board because they were doing a capital campaign.
Mm-hmm.
So they wanted more people on the board so they would have more capital donors. And that often happens in not-for-profits. It's not necessarily healthy, though.
So what were your opinions on Bill McConnell shrinking the board?
Oh, I was all for it.
Mm-hmm. And then you said at our last interview that serving as a chair for the Governance Committee for the Red Cross of Indianapolis was your favorite position you held because you built it, or you helped to build it. How did you build it?
I was the person that decided that we needed an advisory board, which is a group of people who are not elected but are ratified by the board. And they are folks who serve on a committee, who are donors to the Red Cross, but who are not required to attend board meetings, and they're not required to support the Red Cross at the same level as a regular board member. So if you're somebody who has a very busy schedule, but you think you might like to be a Red Cross volunteer in a leadership position, and you want to try us out, the advisory board's a good way to do that. Or if you are a former board member who wants to stay engaged, and you want to continue to be active in board activities, you can go to the advisory board and stay on that board until you're eligible to come back on as a regular board member.
Okay.
So it served two purposes, and it's been a really good feeder system for our board, because the advisory board members then have been working on committees, they're familiar with the organization, they can step right into leadership positions, so we can plot out a succession plan for leadership over a 5 to 7 year period because we know who's on the bench.
Mm-hmm. And then what challenges did you face in building this committee?
Well, we didn't have any challenges building the committee. The challenges come in identifying potential board members. Mm-hmm. And, you know, always the issue is getting the right people with the right skills, working very hard on diversity. We do as good a job as any, but it's still not good enough in terms of trying to recruit diversity candidates because a lot of them are very busy and everybody in town wants them.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's always been a challenge to get a diverse population. Although I will say, when Marcia and I first came on the board, there were 3 women, and now half of the board and half of the advisory board are female. So mm-hmm. we've at least got that part done.
So then what would you say your willingness to rebuild the governance committee say a lot about you as a leader? Or what would you say?
Oh, I wouldn't. I wouldn't. It was an idea that I stole from something else
mm-hmm.
And decided it might be something we should implement, and we did, and it was very successful. Mm-hmm. So
then now I'm going to ask you some questions about your involvement in the natural disaster relief of Hurricane Katrina
mm-hmm.
and your involvement with the disaster relief services as a Red Cross volunteer.
Okay.
I here have an excerpt from the Indiana Business Journal dated September 5th, 2005, and the article states, to give the listener context, "In a time like this, many people in Indianapolis are asking what they can do to help our fellow Americans in need. He said in a prepared statement, the American Red Cross exists for this purpose, so I encourage everyone to coordinate their efforts through them. At our pre-interview, you mentioned how you had been involved in some of the relief efforts for Katrina. I remember you mentioned you had a decent amount of involvement, and I guess my question is, what did you do to help your fellow Americans in this time of need?
Well, most of it was to continue the board work to keep the chapter functioning,
mm-hmm.
given that we suddenly had a whole raft of volunteers who were on the emergency phone system. We had an emergency, we were one of the emergency call centers throughout the country. And the calls that come in are calls from people who are standing on their roof in Louisiana, and they're talking to somebody in Indiana, and they want to know when the people are going to come and rescue them.
Mm-hmm.
And so we trained a whole bunch of volunteers really quickly, and I took that training as well, but I wasn't able to be on the calls because I was working full-time. But we got a lot of students from IUPUI. A lot of our board members would come in and work on the weekends.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was the part that I was involved in. My husband did a lot of the manual labor. The Katrina families that came to Indianapolis were housed at the fairgrounds.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was hauling water and food and supplies back and forth to the fairgrounds. So everybody pretty much pitched in.
Mm-hmm. And then what were the biggest challenges you and other volunteers faced at this point when providing disaster relief?
Well, the being on the call center, the logistics of it, was very stressful for the volunteers to be taking those calls because the people were hysterical. And, you know, there's not any way that you can really help them immediately
mm-hmm.
other than to help route those calls. And that was, the communication systems were totally down. And so part of our job was to be able to route those calls to the first responders in the area so they could take care of it. But it was really hard on the volunteers. And so that was a difficult time. And then we had some issues with the folks who had come up here. We had some of the local African-American pastors felt that the clients that were being housed at the fairgrounds were being discriminated against in some fashion. And our board chair at that time was a guy by the name of Joe Simpson, who was African-American and very well respected in the community. And he pretty much stomped out there and had a nice conversation with the folks and said, you know, just back off. Everybody's getting hot food. Everybody's being taken care of exactly the same. That's the way the Red Cross operates. You need to get off your high horse. And Amos Brown was very helpful in that regard. He got on the radio and talked about, you know, that people need to stop looking for boogeymen under the bed,
mm-hmm.
that, you know, this is we're here to help these people, and that's what we need to be counting on.
So then it was at the state fair shelters this problem was happening?
Yeah, the state fair, the 4-H building is where mm-hmm. we housed the people, but there wasn't a problem. That was the point.
Yeah, and then you were sending someone out, Simpson, to calm everyone
yeah,
down.
Yeah, right.
And I'm actually
right.
going to be interviewing Mr. Simpson.
Oh, good. So he will tell you the story mm-hmm. of the fairgrounds. And
would he mind if I brought it up?
Oh, I know. Heavens no. No.
All right. So then your involvement, a lot of people at this time were coming over from Louisiana to Indianapolis to find housing. There was actually a huge surge of people coming in to find safety. What exactly was the nature of your involvement in helping these families transition from...
I had no direct service involvement with the Katrina families at all, other than what I've articulated mm-hmm. to you. So,
are there any memories about your service during Katrina, helping those that stick out to you?
Just the volunteers telling me how stressful it was to be on the phone. That was pretty much it. I did find after the fact that Second Baptist, which is now Promise of Life Ministries, which is the church of our immediate past board chair, mm-hmm. Had done a remarkable job of bringing families up, getting them housing, getting them job interviews. I mean, they did everything right. And that was one of the reasons that we got acquainted. And then he was the first congregation that volunteered to be part of our faith-based initiative, where we train all of the parishioners in the congregations to be ready to open a shelter immediately and be able to assist their neighbors in ways that are appropriate. And so he really got that off the ground, but it was as a result of the work they did with their Katrina families.
Mm-hmm. And then what lessons did you learn from all of this?
Just that it's, you know, perception is always difficult, and it's just important that everybody is on the same page and remembers what the mission is, and the mission is to help the people that need the help, mm-hmm. And politics and everything else needs to be set aside.
So then Katrina brought a lot of tragedy to the United States, especially for people living in the South. However, through the midst of crisis, compassion was shown in various forms, primarily through monetary donations and action. Volunteers of the Red Cross played a major role in this compassion shown to victims of Hurricane Katrina. After having the opportunity to volunteer during this natural disaster alongside fellow volunteers, what are some valuable lessons you learned?
Again, it's all about community, and I remember the executive director of the Red Cross in New Orleans, who came to speak after the fact. She kind of went around the country to tell her story. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they lost everything as staff people. But she tells the story about their headquarters was completely underwater. And so they kind of set up shop in various places around the city. And she said she remembers watching, there was a grocery store where there was no power. And so the people that owned the grocery store said, look, you know, we have all this meat that's going to go bad if we don't do something with it. And so folks came from all over and brought their grills and everything else and cooked all of it mm-hmm. And fed tons of people and just, you know, made do with what they had. And so that image of that sticks in my mind as, you know, that's America at its best.
So then now we're going to transition and talk about the reorganization of the Red Cross. I remember at our pre-interview you talked about how you were familiar with Senator Grassley and... the action that was taken to reorganize everything. So to give the listener a contextual overview, I'm going to read an excerpt here. After the events of the attacks of September 11, 2001, and the devastation and flooding of Hurricane Katrina in August of 2005, at the national level, many nonprofit organizations, including the American Red Cross, fell under investigation led by Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley and the United States Senate Committee on Finance. In the case of the Red Cross, the criticism ultimately led to the passage of the American National Red Cross Governance Modernization Act of 2007. The American Red Cross Board of Governors, in compliance with the act, embarked upon massive reforms as dictated in an October 2006 report entitled American Red Cross Governance for the 21st Century. So, in regards to this Governance Modernization Act, Can you explain what promoted Senator Grassley and his committee to investigate the Red Cross?
I have no idea. I have absolutely no idea. The Red Cross is a government-chartered organization that receives no funding from the federal government whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
So why he thought it was part of his purview is beyond me.
Mm-hmm. And then on February 27, 2006, the course of the investigation of the Red Cross by the Senate Committee on Finance, Senator Grassley wrote to Miss Bonnie
McElveen-Hunter.
McElveen-Hunter, mm-hmm. Okay. That's how you pronounce her
that
name.
That is, McElveen, Bonnie McElveen-Hunter. Yeah.
She was the chairman of governors of the American Red Cross. Grassley summarized his concerns, and I would like to mention some of those concerns that he had brought up in the letter. Reading from Grassley's letter of February 27, 2006, under the category of independence, the senator made the following observations. An issue for organizations such as the Red Cross, United Way, YMCA, and others is ensuring the proper balance between the field and headquarters. There have unfortunately been very real problems at the chapter level of the Red Cross. To be effective, the Red Cross must vigorously oversee chapters and discipline chapters as well as ensure the national standards are in place and met by the chapters. I have concern that this is not happening to the degree it should because of the chapter's involvements in governance. I understand that a majority of the national board is compromised of representatives from the chapters. So based upon your direct experiences, how would you assess Senator Grassley's observations on the Red Cross chapters?
Okay, so he's absolutely correct that the board members are nominated by the chapters. And they are still nominated by mm-hmm. the chapters. But they are. It's done through the nomination and governance committee of the board, as it should be, just as we do locally.
Mm-hmm.
And so they go through the same rigorous review that we do. You know, what current board member skills do we have? What are the demographics? What are the term limits? I mean, we have, like the national board, we have a very extensive Excel spreadsheet with everybody's terms and when they're coming off and what class they're in and what their skill sets are and what committees they're active in and so on. I would say that the one thing I will credit Senator Grassley for is getting the Board of Governors to move forward. Part of the problem with the Board of Governors prior to the reorganization was that most of the members, the majority, actually, of the members of the Board of Governors were presidential appointees. So if we're going to cast aspersions, let's point the finger in the right way. They were presidential appointees who had no interest in serving on the board, nor did they attend. And typically, the Department of the Navy would send some underling, and the Department of the Army would send some underling, and the Department of Homeland Security would send some underling. And it'd be a different person every time.
Mm-hmm.
So there was no effective governance from that portion at all. And so rightfully, when the board did the reorganization, they went to Board Source, which is the organization that we all use because they do all of the research education in terms of governance and how boards should be run and so on. And they went to Board Source and said, you know, structure this for us. And it basically mimicked the same thing we were doing locally.
Mm-hmm.
And he is right to the extent that many chapters were not in compliance in a lot of different ways. Many chapters thought they had autonomy to hire and fire, and they forgot that there's one tax ID number. And when you have one tax ID number, there can only be one governing board, and those are the people in Washington. Those are not the people local. And we had a lot of pushback from our board members who said, well, you know, they're taking all our power away. You never had it. We were always one 501c3
mm-hmm.
tax ID number. You know, you never had a fiduciary responsibility. That was a very hard pill for a lot of people to swallow, but they should have never thought that in the first place. So it was difficult. We had a lot of chapters who wouldn't turn over their finances. All of that has been changed for the better under both Bonnie and Gail McGovern. We were doing 10,000 audits around the country, all of which cost us $10,000. So do the math. That's a really big number. And now we have one audit. So there were just lots of things that needed to change in the way we worked. It's been very painful, and we have a lot of communities that don't like the Red Cross as a result, because mm-hmm. we took away their Red Cross. Well, their Red Cross never functioned the way it was supposed to. And so, you know, in the interest of the larger organization, you have to do that. But I don't understand what the current issue is with Senator Grassley, other than he would like the Red Cross to become a government agency. And that's the point at which the you know, 150,000, 200,000 volunteers that we have would all pick up their purse and go elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. So then would you say that the Red Cross unintentionally evolved to where people were getting comfortable having more power within the organization than with being controlled by the government? Does that make sense?
No. It's the issue is that because it's government chartered, mm-hmm. I think the senator feels that you know, this should be an organization that is a government agency that has paid employees, mm-hmm. Which, you know, negates our ability to deliver service. Mm-hmm. I mean, we, you know, when you go to a disaster, 90% of the people who are there are volunteers. They're doing it for free. People don't volunteer for government agencies. I mean, that's bottom line. Mm-hmm. You know, they're not going to do that. So now all of a sudden, in order to provide those services, you have increased the cost of providing those services in ways that would be unimaginable. Mm-hmm. And so I don't understand what his agenda is, but, you know, that I don't understand a lot about what goes on in Washington. So,
would you say that some areas of Grassley's assessment were wrong of the Red Cross?
I didn't read the report. Mm-hmm. I didn't dignify it with a response. The things that you have highlighted were things that we did have an issue with. Mm-hmm. And so to that extent, I think he was correct. I can't figure out what his continuing agenda is. Mm-hmm. So
then, as a reminder to listeners, on May 11th, 2007, Congress passed Public Law 110-26, an act to amend the Congressional Charter of the American National Red Cross to modernize its governance structure to enhance the ability of the Board of Governors of the American National Red Cross to support the critical mission of the American National Red Cross in the 21st century and for other purposes. And the Red Cross responded by passing sweeping reforms. What was your response to some of these reforms?
I actually thought they were very timely and very well done. We were all of the chapters were allowed to weigh in on various details within the governance document. We, having a bunch of board groupies on our board, sent back some recommendations mm-hmm. For changes in wording, and those were actually, those changes were made, and rightfully so. There were some weird things in the reporting structures and that kind of stuff that we thought needed to be weeded out, and all of the chapters had the ability to weigh in on the governance document, and then that all got rolled back to the board, and then they hammered out a final thing. So it was a very democratic process. Mm-hmm. I mean, to take, you know, what would have then probably been 1,000 chapters and have them all, you know, give you feedback, you know, was it gave everybody an ownership in the process, and what came out of it, I think, was a substantially improved, well-run organization. So
then the Red Cross outlined its proposed reorganization in a document entitled American Red Cross Governance for the 21st Century, October 2006. How was the American Red Cross restructured? If you could give an overview.
Just the board.
Mm-hmm, just the board. Okay.
Okay. I mean, the Red Cross was restructured when Gail McGovern came, mm-hmm. but those were management structures.
Okay.
This document caused the board to be restructured.
So this was right. Focusing on the
so
board.
So this went from a 60-person board to a 20-person board.
Okay.
And a 20-person board of people who had expertise in international corporations that had multiple branches, mm-hmm. Who had biomedical expertise, all of the expertise that we need to run a $3 billion operation. So
then what do you believe was gained through this?
Oh, economies of scale, mm-hmm. Much tighter reporting on the part of the chapters. I think at the end of the day, better distribution of services without a lot of expense and overlap. And in the old days, every time you had some little disaster, they'd ship people from all over the country. Well, you mm-hmm. got to feed them, you got to house them, you got to transport them. And now what we're teaching the chapters to do is to handle their local disasters up to a certain level before we bother to bring anybody in from out of state, because it's expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can train more volunteers, our exec thinks we probably need another 8,000 volunteers in this community. We have about 1,000, probably 800 of them are active, and we probably need 10 times that to be able to be equipped to handle any kind of disaster. It's important that we spend our time working on that, and that would have not come out had we not done the reorganization. So
then you had very positive reactions.
Absolutely,
to this.
Absolutely.
And then, do you believe anything was lost?
What was lost were the bake sales and the book sales and the little events in Bedford, Indiana,
mm-hmm.
and so the hometown feel of the Red Cross, I think, was lost because many of the small communities in this country no longer have a Red Cross chapter in their community.
Mm-hmm.
They're served by the large metropolitan area that, you know, is closest to them. That doesn't feel the same, and it doesn't feel very good.
Mm-hmm.
And so that part, I think, was not good, but it had to be done. So.
Mm-hmm. So with you being involved, heavily involved as a volunteer in the Red Cross, you have a sort of unique perspective on the reorganization. Or I'm on a wrong question.
No, that's
I apologize.
Okay. Go ahead. No worries.
So it's largest and most... It's one of the nation's most largest and reorganized organizations when it went through this reorganization. My question is, if you had to change one thing about the way the Red Cross manages its volunteers, workers, or missions, what would it be?
I would make the volunteer sign-up site a lot easier and user-friendly for elderly people.
In what ways is it more difficult?
Oh, it's just, it's very hard to log your hours, and we would have a lot better handle. I mean, people put in thousands of hours, and they never write it down anywhere, and so... Our ability to monitor how many hours people actually do volunteer for the Red Cross is really compromised because the volunteer enrollment site is not very user-friendly, and people just don't, you know, if it's a pain, they don't do it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm supposed to be logging all of my hours, and I never get around to it because it's such a nuisance to try to get in and get it all. They don't give you the ability to put in a block of time. You have to put it in day by day by day. Well, you know, forget it. I'm not going to live long enough to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I need to be able to say, okay, I volunteered X number of hours for the last 6 months,
mm-hmm.
You know, at various assorted things. And I do that for Wells Fargo. We have a system that we log all of our volunteer hours, which is why I know I spent 535 hours last year.
Mm-hmm.
But they allow me to put it in all as a block of time, and I literally go through my calendar for the last year and add up month by month how many hours I've spent each month, and then I put it in as one entry and I'm
mm-hmm.
done. Well, that's what the volunteer system needs to do, but we're not there yet. So,
about how, if you can estimate, about how many hours a month do you give to the Red Cross?
Well, last year it was 535 total, so
mm-hmm.
divide that by 12, whatever that number is. It's not quite so bad this year because I'm not chairing the Tiffany Circle, but it's pretty close. I would say I'll probably do 300 hours, so
mm-hmm.
It's probably 30 hours a month,
wow,
something
yeah.
like that.
And then at our pre-interview, you said that the reorganization of the Red Cross was absolutely necessary and that there has been problems occurring that needed fixed. Besides the problems you have mentioned already, were there any other problems that needed to be fixed that were through this reorganization?
Just the transmission of finances and that kind of thing. It was very problematic. Oh, the other thing is we were hosting 780 different websites, because
oh,
every individual chapter had their own website.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so
wow.
That's not a good plan.
Mm-hmm.
It's expensive. Somebody's got to maintain it. Somebody's got to monitor it to make sure that what you put on the website is correct. And so that made no sense whatsoever. So
mm-hmm.
that went away, and now there's one Red Cross website, but you can click on, you can put in your own community and your own community stuff will pull up on that website. That needed to happen a long time ago. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of good that came out of this.
Mm-hmm. And then can you elaborate a little bit more on why these changes were absolutely necessary?
Just the being the best steward of the donor's money. Mm-hmm. I mean, we don't want to waste money on things that we don't need to waste money on. So, and infrastructure is something that nobody's mm-hmm. interested in donating to. So,
You explained at our pre-interview how one of the problems before the reorganization was losing track of how much money was coming in and out of various Red Cross chapters. For the sake of the listeners, can you elaborate on that issue?
We had some Red Cross chapters in the old days who just never bothered to send national headquarters mm-hmm. their financials. And I suggested that perhaps we should remove the Red Cross from their door. And cooler heads prevailed mm-hmm. Because they didn't want to completely lose that community. But it was, again, it was a sense of power that the local Red Cross board had that was not correct. I mean, they, you know, as part of a larger organization, you have to tell them how much money's coming in and going out. Mm-hmm. I can remember going to a board meeting up in Muncie, and they had a volunteer who was trying to download the financials into the accounting package that everybody was using in those days and couldn't get it to work. And this poor soul was coming in every night after work trying to get this done for the Red Cross, and I'm like, this can't be that hard. I mean, Muncie's a little tiny chapter. There's not that much activity, but they just couldn't make it work. And so that needed to be fixed mm-hmm. A long time ago, and fortunately it is now, so...
So then how did this reorganization address this issue?
Well, the reorganization didn't address it. The streamlining of the operation when Gail came did.
Okay.
One thing followed the other, but mm-hmm. She couldn't have made it work if we hadn't gone through the reorganization and reminded the boards that mm-hmm. they were not fiduciaries. That the only reason you have a local board is for local presence and to raise money.
Mm-hmm. And then can you describe what Gail exactly did to fix this issue?
Well, I mean, she pretty much came to work at the Red Cross and said, wait a minute, what do you mean we don't know how much money's coming in and going out? And, you know, she came from corporate America, and that you just don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
And so her first priority was to get the finances organized. And so that's when we went to one accounting package where all the finances are transmitted automatically. You don't have a local bookkeeper.
Mm-hmm.
You have somebody who's make sure it gets done, but you don't have to have a local bookkeeper. You don't have to have a local audit. You don't have to do any of that stuff. So.
Right. So then if you could change one or two things about the reorganization in general, what would those one or two things be?
I wouldn't have changed anything.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it did exactly what it was supposed to do, was to make the Red Cross much more lean and mean. When Gail came, we had a $200 million deficit, which she got rid of in 1 year. That's not an insignificant kind of situation. We have a situation now with our declining revenue from our blood services that has to be balanced out in some mm-hmm. fashion. And so I think it's all been to the good, but it's hard on the volunteers and hard on the long-time Red Crossers, and this is a unique organization in that most of the time, once a Red Cross, always a Red Crosser,
mm-hmm.
And so you get a lot of, we've always done it this way,
mm-hmm.
Those folks aren't happy.
So then, do you mind giving me Gail's full name, just so I have
confidence? Gail McGovern.
Gail McGovern, and it's just spelled exactly how mm-hmm. it sounds?
Yeah, she's the CEO of the Red Cross.
Thank you, because you mentioned her a lot, and I
mm-hmm.
wanted to have her full name so I had some context.
Yes, yeah.
So now we're going to transition
okay.
and talk about your perceptions of leadership.
Okay.
So you have been a success and leader in both the business and volunteer world. What are qualities that account for successful leadership in business?
I think it's... I don't separate them out. I think not-for-profit work and what you do in your business are one and the same.
Mm-hmm.
A good leader is somebody who sets the agenda, lets everybody know what it is we're trying to accomplish, and then gets the hell out of the way and lets them do it. I see more mistakes made by people who micromanage than I can shake a stick at. And you know, if you get the right people on the in the right seats and the bus is going the right direction, you don't need to do anything except be on that bus. And a lot of people don't get that. A lot of people think, you know, you have to manage by intimidation, you have to manage by browbeating, you have to manage by telling everybody exactly what they have to do right down to the last period. My style is, you know, here's what we're trying to accomplish, folks. You have these skills, you figure out how to get it done, and that's all we need to do. And that's, I think that's why, you know, Gail has been successful and Bonnie as well, because they both operate that way. They, you know, tell everybody what needs to be done, and then they get out of the way and let it take its course. So
then you said at our pre-interview that you view yourself as a leader. How do you view yourself as a leader?
Well, I don't, that's kind of a hard question to answer. I've had the privilege of leading a number of different organizations. And I think I got into those positions by being somebody who makes sure that everybody is on the same page. And if we have folks who want to go a different direction, then we have to negotiate how we're going to move forward so that everybody... I'm not concerned that everybody's happy. I'm just concerned that everybody remembers what the mission is and accomplishes the mission. Mm-hmm. So that's the way I've always worked. So
then what do you think are qualities of an effective leader?
Well, just what I articulated, that you make sure that you have the right people in place to accomplish what you want to accomplish, and you do that through a good governance process or a good hiring process if you're in business. Once you've got everybody in place, then it's a matter of setting good strategic direction with measurable outcomes so that everybody knows when they've accomplished what they need to accomplish. And then you just step out of the way and make sure the train stays on the track.
And then what do you think your positions of leadership have allowed you to accomplish?
Personally, a lot of self-satisfaction that when you go into an organization or a career, you leave it in better shape than you found it. And that's my ultimate outcome measurement. If I am a leader of an organization and it's more effective and it's more responsive and it's more well-run after I left than it was when I got there, then I've done everything I need to do.
And then how have your leadership qualities related to your volunteer work?
I actually learned my leadership skills in volunteering because the type of business that I'm in is basically a sole proprietorship. I have a business partner and I have two great colleagues who work with me, but at the end of the day, it's an individual practice. So I could have stayed doing that and never had any of these leadership experiences. So all of them come from the not-for-profit. And I've been on a lot of boards from hell, so I've learned what not to do, and I've watched leaders blow themselves up, so I've learned from that. So it's been the not-for-profit that has honed those skills, if I have any.
If you could change any aspect of your leadership style throughout the years, what would you change?
I probably would cut everybody a little more slack. I don't suffer fools gladly, and so I'm somebody that, you know, wants to set the agenda and then get rolling. And sometimes that's not always the best response. So I probably might have been a little more circumspect in some groups that I've been in.
And then you're currently a financial advisor for Wells Fargo's Advisors. Have your skills in your professional line of work impacted your accomplishments as a volunteer with the Red Cross?
Not really. As I say, my practice is a different animal. I don't have the management requirements that leading an organization requires. So not really related.
Okay. So then now I'm going to ask you some questions to get you to reflect on your volunteering.
Okay.
Of all the organizations you could have selected to spend your time on, why would you pick the Red Cross and stay with them for so long?
Good question. I had my mentor once said to me, the way you decide what organizations you want to work with are you ask yourself, is it important work, is it well run, and is it fun? And if any of those three things are missing, you need to pick up your purse and go somewhere else. And at one time, I served on 13 different boards, and that was when I had this conversation with him. And I went home and removed myself from 10 of those because there was something not right about all of them.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you go into a volunteer organization and you just realize it's so fatally flawed that no matter how long you stayed there, it wasn't going to be fixable. But the Red Cross has always been, to me, an organization that is very important work. Sometimes it's been better run than others. We've stubbed our toes over the years, just like all organizations have. But at the end of the day, the Red Cross volunteers are the ones that make the difference in people's lives.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as they're willing to work, I'm willing to support them.
And then one of the interesting things about volunteering for a nonprofit is that volunteers both give and receive. So I want to start with what you've received. How would you assess the impact of all of the years you worked as a volunteer?
It's all about the people, mm-hmm. the lifelong friendships, the community connections, the sense of community. All of those things are irreplaceable when you volunteer.
And then how has that impacted you?
Well, just made a much better quality of life. I mean,
mm-hmm.
I just recently lost my husband, and mm-hmm. The outpouring from all of the places that I volunteer, all the fellow board members and staff members, and I mean, just, you know, it was a privilege to hear from everybody because, you know, a lot of people don't have that in their lives.
Mm-hmm.
So it was very, very comforting.
So did all of those years volunteering for the Red Cross change your worldviews?
I don't think it changed my worldviews, mm-hmm. necessarily. Actually, I don't think it changed any views at all. It just reinforced the feeling that, you know, if you give people an opportunity, they'll do the right thing.
Mm-hmm. And then what gives you the most satisfaction as you look back on your years of volunteering for the Red Cross?
Oh, I can't really narrow it down. Every engagement had its own positive influence on my life, even if it was the board from hell. I don't know that I could pick any one thing that was, you know, the highlight. Probably the highlight was having the firm recognize that volunteer commitment through the Spirit Award. That was a big deal. So that was very rewarding.
So you earned an award?
That was the mm-hmm. DVD I gave
yeah.
you.
Yeah. I listened to a few minutes of that. But just for the sake of the listeners, can you elaborate more?
Wells Fargo always recognized their financial advisors who do a lot of work in the community. And it's called the Spirit Award. And it goes clear back to when we were Wachovia.
Mm-hmm.
And when you win it, you're celebrated at Premier Advisor's Dinner with hundreds of your colleagues, and they mm-hmm. bronze your hands, which is kind of cool. And so we went for years and watched it happen to other people. And then a couple of years ago, we were down in Miami for the Advisor's Dinner, and I looked up on the Jumbotron, and all of a sudden it was me. But my husband, bless his heart, did a great job of gathering together all the people that I've volunteered with and, mm-hmm. and had them do interviews. And so it was very, very special. And then the president of the company came over to me and he said, you know, actually at the time he was vice president and Danny Ludeman was president, he came over to me and he said, I thought Danny was on every board in town, but he said, you've got him beat way, way far away. So that was very special to have the firm recognize that that's an important part of your work life as well.
Mm-hmm. And then, would you say volunteering changed your life in significant ways?
Oh, yeah, extraordinary mm-hmm. ways. The people I've met, the places I've gone, the difference I've made in people's lives, I mean, that's, you can't replace that.
Then what have you learned through volunteering for the Red Cross?
Just that it's as far as I'm concerned, the only way to run your life. You know, we're put on this earth, and our obligation is to give back some of what we get from God's bounty, and that's the way you do it, mm-hmm. is by helping other people.
So we've talked about what you've received. Let's talk about what you gave. As you look back on your years with the Red Cross, what are the most important things that you contributed?
Oh, I would say probably the chairing the Tiffany Circle for the local chapter, because it brought in significant amounts of additional revenue that are sustainable, and got a lot of wonderful women engaged with the Red Cross that had never given a dime,
mm-hmm.
and helping other chapters recruit Tiffany members, I think, are the two things where I've made the biggest impact.
Are there any times that stand out when you feel as though you made a real difference? Any other times you'd like to share?
No, that's pretty much it.
Mm-hmm. And then, what are the personal qualities that make for a good Red Cross volunteer?
A good heart would be good. Willing to be flexible and do whatever is needed,
mm-hmm.
Because you know, disasters are unpredictable and they don't come at convenient times, and so you have to be ready to go. It's like being a fireman. You train, and then you wait for somebody to ring the bell. So patience is a good virtue for a volunteer, because often you have to wait a long time before they call you to
mm-hmm.
Engage you. So
then, in your experience, what were the most important services that the Red Cross provided during your time as a volunteer?
Oh, well, certainly 9/11 and Katrina, mm-hmm. Of course, the local things that we've done over the years, the floods and the tornadoes and that kind of thing. But lots of other things, first aid and CPR, and, you know, it's 40% of the blood supply. I mean,
mm-hmm.
if we go out of business, people start dying, so... you know, that's a huge part of our business. Not one that I have typically been engaged in, because this particular chapter did not do a lot in the blood services. It was done out of our Fort Wayne chapter, but that's all changed now, so we're more engaged in that process than we were. But, you know, that's all life-saving stuff,
mm-hmm.
you know. So,
what specific skills do you believe you learned or obtained through volunteering for the Red Cross?
Well, certainly the governance piece.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I didn't learn at all, but the implementation of good governance, I got my most practice with the Red Cross. And, you know, I learned CPR, and I've taken all of the classes to open up a shelter and that kind of stuff. But those are not things that I implement on a daily basis. But it's, I would say probably the governance had been the most significant.
So then, how has the Red Cross evolved over the years? In what ways has the Red Cross made major changes? And I know this is a very broad question, but just from your perspective.
Well, the biggest changes, of course, came as a result of the 9/11 and the Grassley and all of the other incidents, and they were all for the better.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's and those are organizations evolve. I mean, the United Way has undergone tremendous change. Because donors are more sophisticated, they're more interested in tracking the outcomes. They want to know what you're doing with their money.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, people in this day and age, people don't give to institutions, they give to outcomes. They give to a particular thing that speaks to them. So the days of just having people who give money because you're the Red Cross are over. People are going to support the things that they are passionate about. And it's not an institution, it's a service.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's very different. And that's changed, you know, everywhere in philanthropy, not just in the Red Cross.
So then, if there were one or two aspects of the Red Cross of Indiana you could change, what would those two things be?
I can't think of anything.
Mm-hmm. And then, during your time with the Red Cross, what have you learned about why people volunteer their time and talent to the organization?
You know, the one thing I've learned is that people typically don't just volunteer for the Red Cross once and then we never see him again.
Mm-hmm.
There's something about wearing that Red Cross vest that hooks people in, and they come and they stay, which is very, very different than most other organizations. Most other organizations, people go, they do their 3 years of service, and they move on to something else. Red Cross never seems to be that way, and that seems to be an international way as well. I mean, the people that I've talked to in the UK and Canada and down in Australia, they've all been Red Crossers all of their lives. These are in countries where volunteerism isn't nearly as rampant as it is here. So there's something about the humanitarian aspect of the Red Cross that speaks to people.
Why do you think that is, that people stay with the Red Cross for a while?
I would say it's the mission.
Mm-hmm. And then one of the other individuals I've interviewed described his worldview and association with the Red Cross in terms as, you've got to put back.
Mm-hmm.
And all it took was for me to spend some time in order for me to give back. So as you think about your association with the Red Cross, what do you believe you have put back?
I've given a lot of time and a lot of money to the organization, and a lot of expertise. And that's, you know, that's about all you can do. So I don't know whether that answers the question
or
not, but yeah, okay.
So then another individual we interviewed told us something very insightful. He said, some people leave the world and you never know they were here. They don't leave any fingerprints.
Mm-hmm.
How have you left your fingerprints in the world?
Oh, I've left large footprints all over places. Certainly in the places that I've volunteered and that sort of thing. You know, somebody will come across a document, you know, 100 years from now and go, who was this woman? and I hope for the better. I hope for the better, yeah.
In what ways have you left your fingerprints specifically in the Red Cross?
Starting the Tiffany Circle is probably the biggest. And the governance, working on that, I think were the two big things.
So you've continuously said throughout our interviews and pre-interview that once you're a Red Crosser, you're always a Red Crosser.
Mm-hmm.
How does this phrase relate to you and your experiences with the Red Cross?
Just as we talked earlier, people that I meet who come once to volunteer for the Red Cross typically keep coming back because there's something appealing about the mission.
So the Red Cross of Indiana is celebrating its 100th anniversary this year. And if you could tell someone 100 years in the future anything about the Red Cross of Indiana right now, what would it be?
It would be that we will still have thousands and thousands of volunteers who will step up to help their neighbors, you know, one family at a time or one disaster at a time. I mean, we respond to over 800 family fires every year, and it's somebody like you or me who gets up in the middle of the night and goes and helps get somebody off the street and into a safe place. And I don't think that will change. You know, I don't think suddenly fires are going to go away. I don't think suddenly tornadoes are going to go away. I think if anything, it's probably going to get worse. People like helping other people. And if we give them a structured forum to do that safely, I think we'll be doing it 100 years from now.
So then, if you were going to tell someone why they should volunteer for the Red Cross 100 years from now, what would you tell them?
Just that. The mission is the same. It's to help your fellow man, and the rewards for that can't be duplicated anywhere else.
So I have two final questions for you, and then we'll be through, because I know you have to get to another appointment.
Thank you.
Is there anything I did not ask that I should have?
I don't think so. That was pretty extensive.
And then is there anything you would like to talk about that you didn't get a chance to?
Oh, no. I covered everything that I thought was important, so.
All right. Well, on behalf of Dr. Scarpino, myself, and the Red Cross, I again want to thank you for taking
the time
to contribute to this oral history project, and thank you for your years of service with the Red Cross.
Thank you. It was very fun chatting with you and remembering all of those things.
Well, with that, I'm going to go ahead and turn off the recording
okay.
machines. That's off.
Great.